The Professor by Charlotte Bronte, Chapter 25. In 2 months more, Frances had fulfilled the time of mourning for her aunt. One January morning, the first of the New Year holidays, I went in a fiacre, accompanied only by Monsieur van der Houten, to the Rue Notre-Dame-en-Neige, and having alighted alone and walked upstairs, I found Frances apparently waiting for me, dressed in a style scarcely appropriate to that cold, bright, frosty day. Never till now had I seen her attired in any other than black or sad-coloured stuff, and there she stood by the window, clad all in white, and white of a most diaphanous texture. Her array was very simple, to be sure, but it looked imposing and festal because it was so clear, full, and floating. A veil shadowed her head and hung below her knee. A little wreath of pink flowers fastened it to her thickly tressed Grecian plait, and thence it fell softly on each side of her face. Singular to state, she was, or had been, crying. When I asked her if she were ready, she said, "Yes, monsieur," with something very like a checked sob, and when I took a shawl which lay on the table and folded it round her, not only did tear after tear course unbidden down her cheek, but she took to my ministration like a reed. I said I was sorry to see her in such low spirits, and requested to be allowed an insight into the origin thereof. She only said, "It was impossible to help it," and then voluntarily, though hurriedly, putting her hand into mine, accompanied me out of the room and ran downstairs with a quick, uncertain step, like one who was eager to get some formidable piece of business over. I put her into the fiacre. Monsieur van der Houten received her and seated her beside himself. We drove all together to the Protestant chapel, went through a certain service in the Common Prayers Book, and she and I came out married. Monsieur van den Houten had given the bride away. We took no bridal trip. Our modesty, screened by the peaceful obscurity of our station and the pleasant isolation of our circumstances, did not exact that additional precaution. We repaired at once to a small house I had taken in the Faubourg, nearest to that part of the city where the scene of our avocations lay. 3 or 4 hours after the wedding ceremony, Frances, divested of her bridal snow and attired in a pretty lilac gown of warmer materials, a piquant black silk apron, and a lace collar with some finishing decoration of lilac ribbon, was kneeling on the carpet of a neatly furnished, though not spacious, parlour, arranging on the shelves of a chiffonniere some books, which I handed to her from the table. It was snowing fast out of doors. The afternoon had turned out wild and cold. The leaden sky seemed full of drifts, and the street was already ankle-deep in the white downfall. Our fire burned bright. Our new habitation looked brilliantly clean and fresh. The furniture was all arranged, and there were but some articles of glass, china, books, and etc. to put in order. Frances found in this business occupation till tea-time, and then after I had distinctly instructed her how to make a cup of tea in rational English style, and after she had got over the dismay occasioned by seeing such an extravagant amount of material put into the pot, she administered to me a proper British repast, at which there wanted neither candies, nor urn, firelight, nor comfort. Our week's holiday glided by, and we addressed ourselves to labour. Both my wife and I began in good earnest with the notion that we were working people, destined to earn our bread by exertion, and that of the most assiduous kind. Our days were thoroughly occupied. Me used to part every morning at 8 o'clock, and not meet again until 5 p.m., but into what sweet rest did the turmoil of each busy day decline. Looking down the vista of memory, I see the evenings passed in that little parlour like a long string of rubies circling the dusk brow of the past. Unvaried were they as each cut gem, and like each gem, brilliant and burning. A year and a half passed. One morning, it was a fate, and we had the day to ourselves, Frances said to me, with a suddenness peculiar to her when she had been thinking long on a subject, and at last, having come to a conclusion, wished to test its soundness by the touchstone of my judgment, "I don't work enough." "What now?" demanded I, looking up from my coffee, which I had been deliberately stirring while enjoying it in anticipation, a walk I proposed to take with Frances that fine summer day, it was June, to a certain farmhouse in the country where we were to dine. "What now?" And I saw at once, in the serious ardour of her face, a project of vital importance. "I am not satisfied," returned she. "You are now earning 8,000 francs a year." It was true. My efforts, punctuality, the fame of my pupil's progress, the publicity of my station had so far helped me on. while I am still at my miserable 1,200 francs. I can do better, and I will. You work as long and as diligently as I do, Francis.
Yes, monsieur.
But I am not working in the right way, and I am convinced of it. You wish to change? You have a plan for progress in your mind? Go and put on your bonnet, and while we take our walk, you shall tell me of it.
Yes, monsieur.
She went, as docile as a well-trained child. She was a curious mixture of tractability and firmness. I sat thinking about her and wondering what her plan could be when she re-entered.
Monsieur, I have given Minnie, our bonne, leave to go out too, as it is so very fine, so will you be kind enough to lock the door and take the key with you?
Kiss me, Mrs. Crimsworth, was my not very apposite reply, but she looked so engaging in her light summer dress and little cottage bonnet, and her manner in speaking to me was then, as always, so unaffectedly and suavely respectful, that my heart expanded at the sight of her, and a kiss seemed necessary to content its importunity.
There, monsieur.
Why do you always call me monsieur? Say William.
I cannot pronounce your W. Besides, monsieur belongs to you. I like it best.
Minnie, having departed in clean cap and smart shawl, we two set out, leaving the house solitary and silent, silent at least, but for the ticking of the clock. We were soon clear of Brussels. The fields received us, and then the lanes, remote from carriage, resounding chaussées. Ere long we came upon a nook so rural, green, and secluded, it might have been a spot in some pastoral English province. A bank of short and mossy grass under a hawthorn offered a seat too tempting to be declined. We took it, and when we had admired and examined some English-looking wildflowers growing at our feet, I recalled Francis's attention and my own to the topic touched on at breakfast. What was her plan? A natural one, the next step to be mounted by us, or at least by her, if she wanted to rise in her profession. She proposed to begin a school. We already had the means for commencing on a careful scale, having lived greatly within our income. We possessed, too, by this time, an extensive and eligible connection in the sense advantageous to our business, for though our circle of visiting acquaintance continued as limited as ever, we were now widely known in schools and families as teachers. When Frances had developed her plan, she intimated in some closing sentences her hopes for the future. If we only had good health and tolerable success, we might, she was sure, in time realize an independency, and that, perhaps, before we were too old to enjoy it. Then both she and I would rest. And what was to hinder us from going to live in England? England was still her promised land. I put no obstacle in her way, raised no objection. I knew she was not one who could live quiescent and inactive, or even comparatively inactive. Duties she must have to fulfill, and important duties, work to do, and exciting, absorbing, profitable work. Strong faculties stirred in her frame, and they demanded full nourishment, free exercise. Mine was not the hand ever to starve or cramp them. No, I delighted in offering them sustenance and in clearing them wider space for action. "You have conceived a plan, Francis," said I, "and a good plan. Execute it. You have my free consent, and wherever and whenever my assistance is wanted, ask, and you shall have." Francis's eyes thanked me almost with tears. Just a sparkle or two soon brushed away. She possessed herself of my hand, too, and held it for some time very close, clasped in both her own. But she said no more than, "Thank you, monsieur." We passed a divine day and came home late, lighted by a full summer moon. 10 years rushed now upon me with dusty, vibrating, unresting wings, years of bustle, action, unslacked endeavor, years in which I and my wife, having launched ourselves in the full career of progress, as progress whirls on in European capitals, scarcely knew repose, were strangers to amusement, never thought of indulgence, and yet, as our course ran side by side, as we marched hand in hand, we neither murmured, repented, nor faltered. Hope indeed cheered us. Health kept us up. Harmony of thought and deed smoothed many difficulties, and finally success bestowed every now and then encouraging reward on diligence. Our school became one of the most popular in Brussels, and as by degrees we raised our terms and elevated our system of education, our choice of pupils grew more select, and at length included the children of the best families in Belgium. We had, too, an excellent connection in England, first opened by the unsolicited recommendation of Mr. Hunsdon,
who, having been over and having abused me for my prosperity in set terms, went back, and soon after sent a leash of young shire heiresses, his cousins, as he said, to be polished off by Mrs. Crimsworth. As to this same Mrs. Crimsworth, in one sense, she was become another woman, though in another she remained unchanged. So different was she under different circumstances. I seemed to possess two wives. The faculties of her nature, already disclosed when I married her, remained fresh and fair. But other faculties shot up strong, branched out broad, and quite altered the external character of the plant. Firmness, activity, and enterprise, covered with grave foliage, poetic, feeling and fervor, but these flowers were still there, preserved pure and dewy under the umbrage of later growth and hardier nature. Perhaps I only in the world knew the secret of their existence, but to me they were ever ready to yield an exquisite fragrance and present a beauty as chaste as radiant. In the daytime, my house and establishment were conducted by Madame, the directress, a stately and elegant woman, bearing much anxious thought on her large brow, much calculated dignity in her serious mien. Immediately after breakfast, I used to part with this lady. I went to my college, she to her schoolroom, returning for an hour in the course of the day. I found her always in class, intently occupied. Silence, industry, observance, attending on her presence. When not actually teaching, she was overlooking and guiding by eye and gesture. She then appeared vigilant and solicitous. When communicating instruction, her aspect was more animated. She seemed to feel a certain enjoyment in the occupation. The language in which she addressed her pupils, though simple and unpretending, was never trite or dry. She did not speak from routine formulas. She made her own phrases as she went on, and very nervous and impressive phrases they frequently were. Often when elucidating favorite points of history or geography, she would wax genuinely eloquent in her earnestness. Her pupils, or at least the elder and more intelligent amongst them, recognized well the language of a superior mind. They felt, too, and some of them received the impression of elevated sentiments. There was little fondling between mistress and girls, but some of Francis's pupils in time learnt to love her sincerely. All of them beheld her with respect. Her general demeanor towards them was serious, sometimes benignant, when they pleased her with their progress and attention, always scrupulously refined and considerate. In cases where reproof or punishment was called for, she was usually forbearing enough. But if any took advantage of that forbearance, which sometimes happened, a sharp, sudden, and lightning-like severity taught the culprit the extent of the mistake committed. Sometimes a gleam of tenderness softened her eyes and manner, but this was rare. Only when a pupil was sick, or when it pined after home, or in the case of some little motherless child, or of one much poorer than its companions, whose scanty wardrobe and mean appointments brought on it the contempt of the jeweled young countesses and silk-clad misses. Over such feeble fledglings, the directress spread a wing of kindliest protection. It was to their bedside she came at night to tuck them warmly in. It was after them she looked in winter to see that they always had a comfortable seat by the stove. It was they who, by turns, were summoned to the salon to receive some little dole of cake or fruit, to sit on a footstool at the fireside, to enjoy home comforts and almost home liberty, for an evening together to be spoken to gently and softly, comforted, encouraged, cherished, and, when bedtime came, dismissed with a kiss of true tenderness. As to Julia and Georgiana, daughters of an English baronet, as to Mademoiselle Mathilde, heiress of a Belgian count, and sundry other children of patrician race, the directress was careful of them as of the others, anxious for their progress as for that of the rest, but it never seemed to enter her head to distinguish them by a mark of preference. One girl of noble blood she loved dearly, a young Irish baroness, Lady Catherine, but it was for her enthusiastic heart and clever head, for her generosity and her genius. The title and rank went for nothing. My afternoons were spent also in college, with the exception of an hour that my wife daily exacted of me for her establishment, and with which she would not dispense. She said that I must spend that time amongst her pupils to learn their characters, to be au courant with everything that was passing in the house, to become interested in what interested her, to be able to give her my opinion on naughty points when she required it, and this she did constantly, never allowing my interest in the pupils to fall asleep, and never making any change of importance without my cognizance and consent. She delighted to sit by me when I gave my lessons, lessons in literature, her hands folded on her knee, the most fixedly attentive of any present. She rarely addressed me in class. When she did, it was with an air of marked deference. It was her pleasure, her joy, to make me still the master in all things. At 6 o'clock p.m. my daily labors ceased. I then came home, for my home was my heaven. Ever at that hour, as I entered our private sitting-room, the lady directress vanished from before my eyes, and Francis Henri, my own little lace-mender, was magically restored to my arms. Much disappointed she would have been if her master had not been as constant to the tryst as herself, and if his truthful kiss had not been prompt to answer her soft, "Bonsoir, monsieur." Talk French to me she would, and many a punishment she has had for her wilfulness. I fear the choice of chastisement must have been injudicious, for instead of correcting the fault, it seemed to encourage its renewal. Our evenings were our own. That recreation was necessary to refresh our strength for the due discharge of our duties. Sometimes we spent them all in conversation, and my young Genovese, now that she was thoroughly accustomed to her English professor, now that she loved him too absolutely to fear him much, reposed in him a confidence so unlimited that topics of conversation could no more be wanting with him than subjects for communion with her own heart. In those moments, happy as a bird with its mate, she would show me what she had of vivacity, of mirth, of originality in her well-dowered nature. She would show, too, some stories of raillery, of malice, and would vex, tease, pique me sometimes about what she called my bizarreries, anglaises, my caprices, insulaires, with a wild and witty wickedness that made a perfect white demon of her while it lasted. This was rare, however, and the elfish freak was always short. Sometimes, when driven a little hard in the war of words, for her tongue did apple justice to the pith, the point, the delicacy of her native French, in which language she always attacked me, I used to turn upon her with my own old decision and arrest bodily the sprite that teased me. Vain idea! No sooner had I grasped hand or arm than the elf was gone, the provocative smile quenched in the expressive brown eyes, and a ray of gentle homage shone under the lids in its place. I had seized a mere vexing fairy, and found a submissive and supplicating little mortal woman in my arms. Then I made her get a book, and read English to me for an hour by way of penance. I frequently dosed her with Wordsworth in this way, and Wordsworth steadied her soon. She had a difficulty in comprehending his deep, serene, and sober mind. His language, too, was not facile to her. She had to ask questions, to sue for explanations, to be like a child and a novice, and to acknowledge me as her senior and director. Her instinct instantly penetrated and possessed the meaning of more ardent and imaginative writers. Byron excited her. Scott she loved. Wordsworth only she puzzled at, wondered over, and hesitated to pronounce an opinion upon. But whether she read to me or talked with me, whether she teased me in French or entreated me in English, whether she jested with wit or inquired with deference, narrated with interest, or listened with attention, whether she smiled at me or on me, always at 9 o'clock, I was left abandoned. She would extricate herself from my arms, quit my side, take her lamp, and be gone. Her mission was upstairs. I have followed her sometimes and watched her. First she opened the door of the dortoir, the pupil's chamber. Noiselessly she glided up the long room between the two rows of white beds, surveyed all the sleepers. If any were wakeful, especially if any were sad, spoke to them and soothed them, stood some minutes to ascertain that all was safe and tranquil, trimmed the watch-light which burned in the apartment all night, then withdrew, closing the door behind her without sound. Thence she glided to our own chamber. It had a little cabinet within, and this she sought. There, too, appeared a bed, but one, and that a very small one. Her face, the night I followed and observed her, changed as she approached this tiny couch. From grave it warmed to earnest. She shaded with one hand the lamp she held in the other. She bent above the pillow and hung over a child asleep. Its slumber, that evening at least, and usually, I believe, was sound and calm. No tear wet its dark eyelashes. No fever heated its round cheek. No ill dream discomposed its budding features. Frances gazed. She did not smile. And yet the deepest delight flushed her face. Feeling pleasurable, powerful, worked in her whole frame, which still was motionless, I saw indeed her heart heave. Her lips were a little apart. Her breathing grew somewhat hurried. The child smiled. Then at last the mother smiled too, and said in low soliloquy, "God bless my little son." She stooped closer over him, breathed the softest of kisses on his brow, covered his minute hand with hers, and at last started up and came away. I regained the parlor before her. Entering it 2 minutes later, she said very quietly as she put down her extinguished lamp, "Victor rests well. He smiled in his sleep. He has your smile, monsieur." The said Victor was, of course, her own boy, born in the 3rd year of our marriage. His Christian name had been given him in honor of Monsieur Van de Houten, who continued always our trusty and well-beloved friend. Frances was then a good and dear wife to me because I was to her a good, just, and faithful husband. What she would have been had she married a harsh, envious, careless man, a profligate, a prodigal, a drunkard, or a tyrant, is another question, and one which I once propounded to her. Her answer, given after some reflection, was, "I should have tried to endure the evil or cure it for a while, and when I found it intolerable and incurable, I should have left my torturer suddenly and silently. And if law or might had forced you back again, what, to a drunkard, a profligate, a selfless spendthrift, an unjust fool? Yes. I would have gone back, again assured myself whether or not his vice and my misery were capable of remedy, and if not, have left him again. And if again forced to return and compelled to abide? I don't know," she said hastily. "Why do you ask me, monsieur?" I would have an answer because I saw a strange kind of spirit in her eye whose voice I determined to waken. "Monsieur, if a wife's nature loathes that of the man she is wedded to, marriage must be slavery. Against slavery all right thinkers revolt, and though torture be the price of resistance, torture must be dared. Though the only road to freedom lie through the gates of death, those gates must be passed, for freedom is indispensable. Then, monsieur, I would resist as far as my strength permitted. When that strength failed, I should be sure of a refuge. Death would certainly screen me both from bad laws and their consequences." "Voluntary death, Francis?" "No, monsieur. I'd have courage to live out every throe of anguish fate assigned me, and principle to contend for justice and liberty to the last." "I see you would have made no patient Grizel. And now, supposing fate had merely assigned you the lot of an old maid, what then? How would you have liked celibacy?" "Not much, certainly. An old maid's life must doubtless be void and vapid, her heart strained and empty. Had I been an old maid, I should have spent existence in efforts to fill the void and ease the aching. I should have probably failed and died weary and disappointed, despised and of no account, like other single women. But I'm not an old maid," she added quickly. "I should have been, though, but for my master. I should never have suited any man but Professor Crimsworth. No other gentleman, French, English, or Belgian, would have thought me amiable or handsome, and I doubt whether I should have cared for the approbation of many others if I could have obtained it. Now I have been Professor Crimsworth's wife 8 years, and what is he in my eyes? Is he honorable? Beloved?" She stopped. Her voice was cut off, her eyes suddenly suffused. She and I were standing side by side. She threw her arms around me and strained me to her heart with passionate earnestness. The energy of her whole being glowed in her dark and then dilated eye and crimsoned her animated cheek. Her look and movement were like inspiration. In one, there was such a flash, in the other, such a power. Half an hour afterwards, when she had become calm, I asked where all that wild vigor was gone which had transformed her erewhile and made her glance so thrilling and ardent, her action so rapid and strong. She looked down, smiling softly and passively. "I cannot tell where it is gone, monsieur," said she, "but I know that, whenever it is wanted, it will come back again." Behold us now at the close of 10 years, and we have realized an independency. The rapidity with which we attained this end had its origin in 3 reasons. Firstly, we worked so hard for it. Secondly, we had no encumbrances to delay success. Thirdly, as soon as we had capital to invest, 2 well-skilled counselors, one in Belgium, one in England, Van de Houten and Hunsdon, gave us each a word of advice as to the sort of investment to be chosen. The suggestion made was judicious, and being promptly acted on, the result proved gainful. I need not say how gainful. I communicated details to the Messrs. Van de Houten and Hunsdon. Nobody else can be interested in hearing them. Accounts being wound up, and our professional connection disposed of, we both agreed that, as Mammon was not our master, nor his service that in which we desired to spend our lives, as our desires were temperate, and our habits unostentatious, we had now abundance to live on, abundance to leave our boy, and should besides always have a balance on hand which, properly managed by right sympathy and unselfish activity, might help philanthropy in her enterprises and put solace into the hands of charity. To England we now resolved to take wing. We arrived there safely. Frances realized the dream of her lifetime. We spent a whole summer and autumn in travelling from end to end of the British Islands and afterwards passed a winter in London. Then we thought it high time to fix our residence. My heart yearned towards my native county, and it is there I now live. It is in the library of my own home I am now writing. That home lies amid a sequestered and rather hilly region, 30 miles removed from the town centre. A region whose verdure the smoke of mills has not yet sullied, whose waters still run pure, whose swells of moorland preserve in some ferny glens that lie between them the very primal wilderness of nature, her moss, her bracken, her bluebells, her scents of reed and heather, her free and fresh breezes. My house is a picturesque and not too spacious dwelling, with low and long windows, a trellised and leaf-veiled porch over the front door just now on this summer evening, looking like an arch of roses and ivy. The garden is chiefly laid out in lawn, formed of the sod of the hills, with herbage short and soft as moss, full of its own peculiar flowers, tiny and star-like, embedded in the minute embroidery of their fine foliage. At the bottom of the sloping garden there is a wicket which opens upon a lane as green as the lawn, very long, shady, and little frequented. On the turf of this lane generally appear the first daisies of spring, whence its name, Daisy Lane, serving also as a distinction to the house. It terminates, the lane I mean, in a valley full of wood, which wood, chiefly oak and beech, spreads shadowy about the vicinage of a very old mansion, one of the Elizabethan structures much larger as well as more antique than Daisy Lane, the property and residence of an individual familiar both to me and to the reader. Yes, in Hunsdon Wood, for so are those glades in that grey building with many gables and more chimneys named, abides York Hunsdon, still unmarried, never, I suppose, having yet found his ideal, though I know at least a score of young ladies within a circuit of 40 miles who would be willing to assist him in the search. The estate fell to him by the death of his father 5 years since. He has given up trade after having made by it sufficient to pay off some encumbrances by which the family heritage was burdened. I say he abides here, but I do not think he is resident about 5 months out of the 12. He wanders from land to land and spends some part of each winter in town. He frequently brings visitors with him when he comes to this area, and those visitors are often foreigners. Sometimes he has a German metaphysician, sometimes a French savant. He had once a dissatisfied and savage-looking Italian who neither sang nor played, and of whom Francis affirmed that he had tout l'air d'un conspirateur. What English guests Hunsdon invites are all either men of Birmingham or Manchester, hard men, seemingly knit up in one thought, whose talk is of free trade. The foreign visitors, too, are politicians. They take a wider theme, European progress, the spread of liberal sentiments over the continent. On their mental tablets, the names of Russia, Austria, and the Pope are inscribed in red ink. I have heard some of them talk vigorous sense. Yea, I have been present at polyglot discussions in the old oak-lined dining-room at Hunsdon Wood, where a singular insight was given of the sentiments entertained by resolute minds respecting old northern despotisms and old southern superstitions. Also, I have heard much twaddle, enounced chiefly in French and Deutsch, but let that pass. Hunsdon himself tolerated the drivelling theorists with the practical men he seemed leagued hand and heart. When Hunsdon is staying alone at the wood, which seldom happens, he generally finds his way 2 or 3 times a week to Daisy Lane. He has a philanthropic motive for coming to smoke his cigar in our porch on summer evenings. He says he does it to kill the earwigs amongst the roses with which insects, but for his benevolent fumigations, he intimates we should certainly be overrun. On wet days, too, we are almost sure to see him. According to him, it gets on time to work me into lunacy by treading on my mental corns, or to force from Mrs. Crimsworth revelations of the dragon within her by insulting the memory of Hofer and Tell. We also go frequently to Hunston Wood, and both I and Francis relish a visit there highly. If there are other guests, their characters are an interesting study. Their conversation is exciting and strange. The absence of all local narrowness, both in the host and his chosen society, gives a metropolitan, almost a cosmopolitan, freedom and largeness to the talk. Hunston himself is a polite man in his own house. He has, when he chooses to employ it, an inexhaustible power of entertaining guests. His very mansion, too, is interesting. The rooms look storied, the passages legendary. The low-ceiled chambers, with their long rows of diamond-paned lattices, have an old-world haunted air. In his travels, he collected stores of articles of vertu, which are well and tastefully disposed in his panelled or tapestried rooms. I have seen there one or two pictures, and one or two pieces of statuary, which many an aristocratic connoisseur might have envied. When I and Francis have dined and spent an evening with Hunsdon, he often walks home with us. His wood is large, and some of the timber is old and of huge growth. There are winding ways in it which, pursued through glade and brake, make the walk back to Daisy Lane a somewhat long one. Many a time, when we have had the benefit of a full moon, and when the night has been mild and balmy, when, moreover, a certain nightingale has been singing, and a certain stream, hid in alders, has lent the song a soft accompaniment, the remote church bell of the one hamlet in a district of 10 miles has told midnight, ere the Lord of the Wood left us at our porch. Free-flowing was his talk at such hours, and far more quiet and gentle than in the daytime and before numbers. He would then forget politics and discussion, and would dwell on the past times of his house, on his family history, on himself, and his own feelings, subjects each and all invested with a peculiar zest, for they were each and all unique. One glorious night in June, after I had been taunting him about his ideal bride, and asking him when she would come and graft her foreign beauty on the old Hunston oak, he answered suddenly, "You call her ideal, but see, here is her shadow, and there cannot be a shadow without a substance." He had led us from the depth of the winding way into a glade from whence the beeches withdrew, leaving it open to the sky. An unclouded moon poured her light into this glade, and Hunston held out under her beam an ivory miniature. Francis, with eagerness, examined it first. Then she gave it to me, still, however, pushing her little face close to mine, and seeking my eyes what I thought of the portrait. I thought it represented a very handsome and very individual-looking female face with, as he had once said, straight and harmonious features. It was dark, the hair raven black, swept not only from the brow but from the temples, seemed thrust away carelessly as if such beauty dispensed with, nay, despised arrangement. The Italian eye looked straight into you, and an independent, determined eye it was. The mouth was as firm as fine, the chin ditto. On the back of the miniature was gilded Lucia. "That is a real head," was my conclusion. Hunston smiled. "I think so," he replied. "All was real in Lucia. And she was somebody you would have liked to marry, but could not?" "I should certainly have liked to marry her, and that I have not done so is a proof that I could not." He repossessed himself of the miniature, now again in Francis' hand, and put it away. "What do you think of it?" he asked of my wife, as he buttoned his coat over it. "I am sure Lucia once wore chains and broke them," was the strange answer. "I do not mean matrimonial chains," she added, correcting herself as if she feared misinterpretation, "but social chains of some sort. The face is that of one who has made an effort, and a successful and triumphant effort, to wrest some vigorous and valued faculty from insupportable constraint. And when Lucia's faculty got free, I am certain it spread wide pinions and carried her higher than—" She hesitated. "Then what?" demanded Hunston. "Then les conveniences permitted you to follow." "I think you grow spiteful, impertinent." "Lucia has trodden the stage," continued Francis. "You never seriously thought of marrying her. You admired her originality, her fearlessness, her energy of body and mind. You delighted in her talent, whatever that was, whether song, dance, or dramatic representation. You worshipped her beauty, which was of the sort after your own heart. But I am sure she filled a sphere from whence you would never have thought of taking a wife."
"Ingenious," remarked Hunsdon. "Whether true or not is another question. Meantime, don't you feel your little lamp of a spirit wax very pale beside such a girandole as Lucia's?"
"Yes." "Candid, at least, and the professor will soon be dissatisfied with the dim light you give."
"Will you, monsieur?"
"My sight was always too weak to endure a blaze, Francis, and we had now reached the wicket. I said a few pages back that this is a sweet summer evening. It is. There has been a series of lovely days, and this is the loveliest. The hay is just carried from my field. Its perfume still lingers in the air. Francis proposed to me an hour or two since to take our tea out on the lawn. I see the round table, loaded with china, placed under a certain beech. Hunsdon is expected. Nay, I hear he has come. There is his voice, laying down the law on some point with authority. That of Francis replies. She opposes him, of course. They are disputing about Victor, of whom Hunsdon affirms that his mother is making a milksop. Mrs. Crimsworth retaliates. Better 1,000 times he should be a milksop than what he, Hunsdon, calls a fine lad. And moreover, she says that if Hunsdon were to become a fixture in the neighborhood, and were not a mere comet coming and going, no one knows how, when, where, or why, she should be quite uneasy till she had got Victor away to a school at least 100 miles off. For that, with his mutinous maxims and unpractical dogmas, he would ruin a score of children. I have a word to say of Victor ere I shut this manuscript in my desk, but it must be a brief one, for I hear the tinkle of silver on porcelain. Victor is as little of a pretty child as I am of a handsome man, or his mother of a fine woman. He is pale and spare, with large eyes as dark as those of Francis, and as deeply set as mine. His shape is symmetrical enough, but slight. His health is good. I never saw a child smile less than he does, nor one who knits such a formidable brow when sitting over a book that interests him, or while listening to tales of adventure, peril, or wonder, narrated by his mother, Hunsdon, or myself. But though still he is not unhappy, though serious, not morose, he has a susceptibility to pleasurable sensations almost too keen, for it amounts to enthusiasm. He learned to read in the old-fashioned way out of a spelling-book at his mother's knee, and as he got on without driving by that method, she thought it unnecessary to buy him ivory letters or to try any of the other inducements to learning now deemed indispensable. When he could read, he had become a glutton of books, and is so still. His toys have been few, and he has never wanted more. For those he possesses, he seems to have contracted a partiality amounting to affection. This feeling, directed towards one or two living animals of the house, strengthens almost to a passion. Mr. Hunsdon gave him a mastiff cub, which he called York, after the donor. It grew to a superb dog, whose fierceness, however, was much modified by the companionship and caresses of its young master. He would go nowhere, do nothing without York. York lay at his feet while he learned his lessons, played with him in the garden, walked with him in the lane and wood, sat near his chair at meals, was fed always by his own hand, was the first thing he sought in the morning, the last he left at night. York accompanied Mr. Hunsdon one day to another town, and was bitten in the street by a dog in a rabid state. As soon as Hunsdon had brought him home, and had informed me of the circumstances, I went into the yard and shot him where he lay licking his wound. He was dead in an instant. He had not seen me level the gun. I stood behind him. I had scarcely been 10 minutes in the house when my ear was struck with sounds of anguish. I repaired to the yard once more, for they proceeded thence. Victor was kneeling beside his dead mastiff, bent over it, embracing its bull-like neck, and lost in a passion of the wildest woe. He saw me. "Oh, Papa, I'll never forgive you, I'll never forgive you," was his exclamation. "You shot York, I saw it from the window. I never believed you could be so cruel. I can love you no more." I had much ado to explain to him, with a steady voice, the stern necessity of the deed. He still, with that inconsolable and bitter accent which I cannot render, but which pierced my heart, repeated, "He might have been cured. You should have tried. You should have burnt the wound with a hot iron or covered it with caustic. You gave no time, and now it is too late. He is dead." He sank fairly down on the senseless carcass. I waited patiently a long while, till his grief had somewhat exhausted him, and then I lifted him in my arms and carried him to his mother, sure that she would comfort him best. She had witnessed the whole scene from a window. She would not come out for fear of increasing my difficulties by her emotion, but she was ready now to receive him. She took him to her kind heart, and onto her gentle lap, consoled him, but with her lips, her eyes, her soft embrace, for some time, and then, when his sobs diminished, told him that York had felt no pain in dying, and that if he had been left to expire naturally, his end would have been most horrible. Above all, she told him that I was not cruel, for that idea seemed to give exquisite pain to poor Victor, and that it was my affection for York and him which had made me act so, and that I was now almost heartbroken to see him weep thus bitterly. Victor would have been no true son of his father had these considerations, these reasons, breathed in so low, so sweet a tone, married to caresses so benign, so tender, to looks so inspired with pitying sympathy, produced no effect on him. They did produce an effect. He grew calmer, rested his face on her shoulder, and lay still in her arms. Looking up shortly, he asked his mother to tell him over again what she had said about York having suffered no pain, and my not being cruel, the balmy words being repeated. He again pillowed his cheek on her breast, and was again tranquil. Some hours after, he came to me in my library, asked if I forgave him, and desired to be reconciled. I drew the lad to my side, and there I kept him a good while, and had much talk with him, in the course of which he disclosed many points of feeling and thought I approved of in my son. I found, it is true, few elements of the good fellow, or the fine fellow in him, scant sparkles of the spirit which loves to flash over the wine-cup, or which kindles the passions to a destroying fire. But I saw in the soil of his heart healthy and swelling germs of compassion, affection, fidelity. I discovered in the garden of his intellect a rich growth of wholesome principles, reason, justice, moral courage, promised, if not blighted, a fertile bearing, so I bestowed on his large forehead and on his cheek, still pale with tears, a proud and contented kiss, and sent him away comforted. Yet I saw him the next day, laid on the mound under which York had been buried, his face covered with his hands. He was melancholy for some weeks, and more than a year elapsed before he would listen to my proposal of having another dog. Victor learns fast. He must go to Eton, where I suspect his first year or two will be utter wretchedness. To leave me, his mother, and his home will give his heart an agonized wrench. Then the fagging will not suit him, but emulation, thirst after knowledge, the glory of success, will stir and reward him in time. Meantime, I feel in myself a strong repugnance to fix the hour which will uproot my soul olive branch and transplant it far from me, and when I speak to Francis on the subject, I am heard with a kind of patient pain, as though I alluded to some fearful operation at which her nature shudders, but from which her fortitude will not permit her to recoil. The step must, however, be taken, and it shall be, for though Francis will not make a milksop of her son, she will accustom him to a style of treatment, a forbearance, a congenial tenderness, he will meet with from no one else. She sees, as I also see, a something in Victor's temper, a kind of electrical ardor and power which emits now and then ominous sparks. Hunsdon calls it his spirit, and says it should not be curbed. I call it the leaven of the offending Adam, and consider that it should be, if not whipped out of him, at least soundly disciplined, and that he will be cheap of any account of either bodily or mental suffering which will ground him radically in the art of self-control. Francis gives this something in her son's marked character no name, but when it appears in the grinding of his teeth, in the glittering of his eye, in the fierce revolt of feeling against disappointment, mischance, sudden sorrow, or supposed injustice, she folds him to her breast, or takes him to walk with her alone in the wood. Then she reasons with him like any philosopher, and to reason Victor is ever accessible. Then she looks at him with eyes of love, and by love Victor can be infallibly subjugated. But will reason or love be the weapons with which in future the world will meet his violence? Oh, no. For that flash in his black eye, for that cloud on his bony brow, for that compression of his statuesque lips, the lad will some day get blows instead of blandishments, kicks instead of kisses. Then, for the fit of mute fury which will sicken his body and madden his soul, then for the ordeal of merited and salutary suffering, out of which he will come, I trust, a wiser and a better man. I see him now. He stands by Hunsdon, who is seated on the lawn under the beech. Hunsdon's hand rests on the boy's collar, and he is instilling God knows what principles into his ear. Victor looks well just now, for he listens with a sort of smiling interest. He never looks so like his mother as when he smiles. Pity the sunshine breaks out so rarely. Victor has a preference for Hunsdon, full as strong as I deem desirable, being considerably more potent, decided, and indiscriminating than any I ever entertained for that personage myself. Frances, too, regards it with a sort of unexpressed anxiety. While her son leans on Hunsdon's knee or rests against his shoulder, she roves with restless movement round like a dove guarding its young from a hovering hawk. She says she wishes Hunsdon had children of his own, for then he would better know the danger of inciting their pride and indulging their foibles. Frances approaches my library window, puts aside the honeysuckle which half covers it, and tells me tea is ready. Seeing that I continue busy, she enters the room, comes near me quietly, and puts her hand on my shoulder. "Monsieur, est trop appliqué?" "I shall soon have done." She draws a chair near and sits down to wait till I have finished. Her presence is as pleasant to my mind as the perfume of the fresh hay and spicy flowers, as the glow of the westering sun, as the repose of the midsummer eye are to my senses. But Hunsdon comes. I hear his step, and there he is, bending through the lattice, from which he has thrust away the woodbine with unsparing hand, disturbing two bees and a butterfly. "Crimsworth, I say, Crimsworth, take that pen out of his hand, mistress, and make him lift up his head." "Well, Hunsdon, I hear you." "I was at the Shire yesterday. Your brother Ned is getting richer than Croesus by railway speculations. They call him in the Peace Hall a stag of 10, and I have heard from Brown. Monsieur and Madame Van Houten and Jean-Baptiste talk of coming to see you next month. He mentions the Palais, too. He says their domestic harmony is not the finest in the world, but in business they are doing on ne peut mieux, which circumstances he concludes will be a sufficient consolation to both for any little crosses in the affections. Why don't you invite the Palais here, Crimsworth? I should so like to see your first flame, Zered. Mistress, don't be jealous, but he loved that lady to distraction. I know it for a fact. Brown says she weighs 12 stones now. You see what you've lost, Mr. Professor. Now, Monsieur and Madame, if you don't come to tea, Victor and I will begin without you. Papa, come." The End of the Professor. Read by Rick Kishner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.